Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Bryce Castillo, filling in for Andrew Main one more time. Joined, as always, by Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, Andrew Main, on assignment. I always wanted to say that. I'm here for Andrew Main, who is on assignment.
You know, and by the way, it might be more than Andrew Main on assignment. This guy, he's out doing crazy stuff. Who knows if anyone will ever hear from him ever again.
Yeah. Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Hopefully when he comes back, it's in grand epic style.
Nope. I think he's gone.
He's collecting those checks and a hermit in the woods.
I know. Although, by the way, we do want to point out that his new book, The Looking Glass, is available. That is the new book in the Naturalist series. It came out last week, so we definitely want to support that. If you enjoyed The Naturalist, then go ahead and get Looking Glass right now. And as always, if you like it and you read it, the best way that you can support it is to review it. Mm-hmm. Always a big thing to read and review your favorite writers. And let me just say this. They always just have the Amazon or the people that make his books. Those book covers are just dank.
They look great.
And this is on Audible, it looks like. So you can also get an audiobook version of it if you like.
Yeah, I believe I already bought it. It's next up. I just finished my previous book, but man, oh man, did I love The Naturalist. I think it's my favorite of all of Andrew's novels.
There you go. We've got a couple of stories here today to talk about, to get a little weird with you guys. We've talked a lot about drones on this show.
Drones.
Real quick, like, what are the various applications from micro to macro of drones on society?
First of all,
I understand it is number one, there to deli slice Brian's hand open.
Yeah, okay, all right, that's okay. Number one. Yeah. Number two, wedding photography.
Okay.
Three, majestic sweeping shots of vistas to let us know we're in Lannisport.
Okay, more photography.
Also chopping up my hands again, coming back a second time.
So those are our four things: chopping up your hands twice, and photography twice.
Yes, yes.
But also like Amazon delivery drones.
Have we seen any practical application of that? I know we all feel like it's on the horizon, but it's so. We did cover a story of first aid being delivered by a drone.
Okay.
So I guess. Object delivery and reconnaissance. Sure. And
short to medium length travel. We've talked about drones that will take you across the Bay Area or something.
Oh, that's right. Quadcopters.
I mean, those I think are a different. They're almost a different breed. Like same family, different breed in terms of like what we would understand to be autonomous vehicles that through computing can just like go from one path to another and either take a picture or have something in its grasp that they can deliver. But certainly, we've seen, I mean, Amazon has made a big deal over the last few years in showing off their drone technology to 60 Minutes, whether or not they're on the verge of actually doing anything with it. I think that there's no doubt that as the United States kind of regulate more and more exactly what it means to operate and fly a drone, that we will see more of them out there.
Even on a very personal level, right? Drones are just toys. You can just play with drones. They're drone races.
Yeah, one of my favorite drone applications was a bracelet. This was like a CES show. I don't know that it ever became available, but a bracelet that you would pull off, you would throw it in the air, it would real quick start flying, orient itself towards you, snap a selfie, and then come back, land in your hand, became a bracelet again.
Oh, cool.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah. So in
micro drones, I guess, would be the words.
Yeah, I guess that sounds about right. So South by Southwest is happening right now. And at South by Southwest, a new possible application for drones was unveiled. This is coming out of the
drone hosts of podcasts. It just goes whzz, whzz.
Yep. They really drone on.
They only come in the white model.
this is a new piece of technology out of the University of Tokyo.
Dunks in basketball. It would allow you the jumping power to leap high enough.
Oh, God, this is horrific.
Creating the potential for new kinds of sports. And with humans able to jump from one side of the street to the other, we wouldn't need crosswalks anymore.
What?
Nor entrances to buildings built on the first floor. Wheelchairs would also become unnecessary, thus changing the whole concept of so-called barrier-free.
This is not real. Areas.
Understanding the feeling of walking on the moon while staying on Earth
so
could also
this is for the audio listeners.
In space exploration.
This is a backpack with two giant fans above them that basically is constantly... It's like standing inches underneath two helicopters, just blasting air down so that you can experience 1/6 normal gravity.
Ryan, remember remember when you first played Super Mario, the first one?
Yeah, right? Sure.
And then you played Super Mario 2 and everybody like hung up in the air that much longer?
Yeah, sure, like, sure.
That's basically what the difference between a regular leap and what these people are promising.
Which would explain why this comes to us from Japan.
Yes.
So this is a device from students of the University of Tokyo.
Oh my God, this is insane. Oh, these animations are hilarious and adorable.
So the idea is that this is a drone technology you could wear as a backpack. And it would assist you in jumping. It could make you jump 2 to 3 times higher than normal.
Man, okay, you know what this is? This is a theme park attraction, and that's about it.
Okay, would be a fun attraction. I mean, we do have, you know, amusement VR things in malls.
Sure, sure. And truthfully, like, I went to Space Camp, and they have this area where they have this rigging with springs that you would wear a harness, and then you got to experience, you know, lunar 1/6 gravity, and you would walk about 20 feet from one side to another. That was novel and fun and a precious memory of mine as a child. I would imagine it would be considerably more fun to have a football field to go running and bounding around and fly up and down and stuff.
All right. Well, let me ask you this though. Mm-hmm. So understood, sure, that the amusement. But if we were forced to come up with a workaday application for it, I think it would certainly be very specialized. But you know, how different is this than a bike for a bike messenger or something? Something that somebody can expend less energy and get faster. You know, get to places faster.
Or like one of those warehouse exosuits that help you carry heavier loads.
I think the mitigating factor for me is all I could think of is the insane sound at all times. And I think that's one of the biggest problems we're going to have with drone technology in general is that the sound, like everybody underestimates just how much noise pollution all of these generate. Now with delivery drones, they have the solution of being able to fly up vertically to a level that they don't disturb people underneath them. You might barely hear a zipping or whatever, but it'll sound like less than an airplane flying, you know, at 30,000 feet above you.
Sure. But imagine that the noise problem is solved. We get better electric motors or better lubrication. I don't even know where the sound necessarily comes from. But
I don't want to speculate on how they would do that. But yeah. Because I'm already thinking like, well, if you broadcast like noise canceling waves, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Because that was one of the exciting things. Justin, you remember when we did the VR stuff and we went to the New World Symphony and they wave their hands to this giant park where thousands of people gather and it's right behind a major thoroughfare. And so there's traffic noise all over. And they say like, yeah, all of these columns have noise canceling speakers. So when you stand there, you don't hear the traffic behind
negative.
You.
Yeah. The negative sound waves.
It's a big symphony where people can sit outside, not pay the money to be in there, and just enjoy the symphony. But not only is it keeping all the audio, it's preserving the fidelity of the audio if you're just sitting out there, but it also all the speakers are pointed in and fairly targeted, so it doesn't just totally take over the entire block as well. Like you kind of have to be like in this little area to hear it, which is really rad.
What does it look like? Assuming that these weaknesses get solved.
So I would imagine...
Because this becomes a space... Like one of the interesting things is the idea of, like, buildings that don't need to have entrances on the first floor.
Okay, that's not true.
But you
know what's funny is I went to a similar place. I picture the beverage guy at the ball game is just like, instead of throwing hot dogs or whatever, he's got a beer and he just bounds up and then lands next to you and hands you one, or lands on the person next to you.
Yeah, you would need lids. You would really want lids for this.
But you are very, very, very wise in pointing out the idea that there's a huge reason why you do not see the founder of these drone companies talking in front of their products that are in use right behind them. You see a lot of musical scored, beautiful, like lifting up, lifting down, but not a lot of.
I'll tell you what, though, man. As a novelty, imagine a park like the ultimate parkour park where it's just you're bounding up a story at a time and leaping from building to building. Although if you miss the building, you're still going to.
Or like at.
I guess it could wind up enough to save your life.
Does it make sense as like farm equipment? Like just to, if you are just, you know, Farmer John and you want to get a look at your crops in a different way that you wouldn't normally, to just leap over them?
Possibly. It could give you a short term vantage point that you might
What if you were doing like specific let's say there were specifically blighted areas and it's a pain in the butt, like you're not going to fly over them, you actually have to get down to the roots or something, you know, you have to jump up, see some blight, jump over to it, get down, spray the roots, and then jump up to another spot. Because otherwise, you're going to have to, you know, do this weird grid up, down, left, right, Pac-Man move to get there.
Or the Grand Canyon. Imagine going to, say, the Grand Canyon and having one of these and using them to go up and down the...
Yeah.
Oh, no?
I can see people doing it. Like,
oh, yeah, but I mean, all right, so you said Grand Canyon, Bryce, and I immediately went to like, you know, Evel Knievel.
Evel Knievel, yeah.
I'm not jumping off of it, but I mean climbing up, you know, the long, arduous pathways up and down.
No, but just like extreme hiking. Like just like something between hiking and mountain climbing.
You know what it would be? It would be the equivalent of Segway tours. So just like they have Segway tours in San Francisco or whatever, and they all go through. Yeah. You could do that because, like, yeah, I want to see the Grand Canyon, but I want to see all of it, and I want it to take about an hour. So let's just go, and then it's like you just bounce around. You're like, oh no, this is adorable.
Or like using one of these to like climb like the Chichen Itza. Like,
yes,
get up these like,
oh my god, how quickly will that be the new eye rolling thing where it's like, I'm halfway up Chichen Itza and all of a sudden these old ladies start bouncing around like they're lunar superstars.
Oh, look at me.
Like, hey, shut up, jerks. I'm having a religious experience.
This company here, how far along are they? Did they demo somewhere? Like, why are they on our radar?
Now, this is a team of University of Tokyo students, so this is almost certainly a school project. At South by Southwest, they had a non-functioning prototype shown off. And it's the sort of thing where they, you know, they're showing this at a convention, so there's not even an announcement that this is an actual product. But it's an interesting technology.
Well, and here's what it really does is it's an indicator of that there are lots of cracks and crevices and odd applications that nobody's thought of yet, and this is the kind of insane out of the box thinking that that we're gonna get.
And I do think that there is a I think the one thing that is really interesting that they point out, and I have no idea how this medically works, and I'm sure that we can have doctors tell us that you just can't have a drone halo over somebody in a wheelchair and have them, you know, bound around and stuff like that. But
I think that's the one that really drove me nuts, is a guy gets out of his wheelchair, leaps over some stairs to where there's not another wheelchair waiting for him.
But I mean, some kind of assistance in propping somebody up. I mean, if you look at it as maybe like crutch substitutes or something like that. So maybe not people that don't have feeling in their legs.
Not people are paralyzed, you know? but maybe just have reduced walking capability.
Yeah. But I think, Brian, you're right. In terms of the everyday usage of it, it's as long as we are in a world where fans cause noise, it will not be socially acceptable to just be worrying your way through Disney World.
So, and again, I don't want to be the guy just pooping all over things because who knows, maybe somebody will find the right application. After all, the Segway finally found its niche with mall cops and rich magicians in comedy series.
Okay. Yep. as was always promised, the final goal.
But outside of that, it really does feel like it feels like they had three good ideas and they're like, yeah, but we need five for this demo. And then what about
wheelchair?
Yes.
One of the other interesting examples that they show is like this guy dunking a basketball and the idea that you could make a sport that takes advantage of this, similar to like those bumper ball soccer games or
I think it was called Slam Ball. Bryce, see if you can find it. But Slam Ball was basketball.
Oh, trampolines.
Yeah.
Super dangerous. Everybody dying is best would imagine.
There was a lot of broken ankles and legs. It did not.
Oh, look at this court, too. It's a mess.
And you got double bounces to deal with. You could send somebody rocketing face first into the metal rim of the basket.
There have been a few different ways to kind of, spice up sports. Ultimately, it's...
This is really funny, though. Like,
I mean, they should be wearing full contact padding. This is insane. They're going to clobber each other.
They had to pad the rim, you could see. Oh, my goodness.
There's definitely a history of trying to gussy up various sports that have had limited success.
All right, well, take that, University of Tokyo.
I want them to succeed because it's so ridiculous. I would love it to be wrong as hell on this.
Okay, let's do another topic here before we get into our Patreon plug. Over the past week, I believe, we unfortunately lost Stephen Hawking. He unfortunately passed away. It has come out now that he submitted a scientific paper, or was a part of a scientific paper that was submitted about 2 weeks before his passing, which the paper talks about possible ways to measure and detect parallel universes.
This is interesting. So this is different from the string theory idea of multiple brains. Like, this is going way back, but in The Elegant Universe, Brian Greene mentions the theory that there are brains, B-R-A-N-E, and that these are entire collections of strings that make up whatever, and that our universe, our Big Bang event, was two brains smashing into each other, and our universe was born. And the theory was, parallel universes, as he described them, the only way we could tell the universe next door would be through gravity waves, and they would be, extremely powerful pulses that could be detected from one to the other. It was all highly theoretical and mathematical. Is that the direction Hawking was working on, or is this a different version of the parallel universe?
Sure. Let me read you what was reported here from Business Insider Australia. The paper's called "A Smooth Exit from Eternal Inflation." According to reporting from the Sunday Times, the paper sets out the mathematics necessary for a deep space probe to collect evidence that might prove other universes exist. The highly theoretical work posits that evidence of the multiverse could be measurable in background radiation dating back to the beginning of time. This, in turn, could be used to measure. Could be measured by a deep space probe with the correct sensors. The paper was only had changes approved about 2 weeks ago, so it's not fully published yet. It is on its way, but we know at least generally this is the idea behind it.
So is there a reason he did release it, or it was unreleased?
He is a co-author on it, and revisions had been approved, but it is still yet to be fully published.
Oh, interesting.
Because there are other authors, I think, either still working on it or
I think
it's just not published.
I think this might be my favorite part about Hawking's legacy. Is he is in the pantheon of folks like, Einstein and, I guess Newton. Nowadays, we don't get surprised by confirmations of Newton's theories, but 100 years after his greatest works, we're still saying Einstein was right. We finally have the instruments to reveal, and the stuff that Hawking is doing, it's going to be centuries that we're going to be seeing headlines. Hawking was right for this reason or that reason.
Now, to broaden this topic out a little bit, what do you think? Let's say this paper goes through in 10 years, in 30 years, we're all still alive and very healthy and doing the Weird Things podcast. What would the discovery of a multiverse theory, or rather a confirmation of a multi-universe theory, or the detection of another parallel universe?
What would that mean? Change?
What would it mean?
What would that have to do with the price of butter?
Sure.
Because, in
larger macro scale also.
So, Justin and I feel like we've chatted about this a bit. This is one of those long drive chats that I remember telling you. My friend Gus Davis asked me, "Hey, what if we found out for a fact that there are aliens light years away from us? What would that change?" And I told him, like all great philosophical discoveries, kind of nothing, but also kind of everything, you know? I don't know. What's your take on it?
I think your initial sketch out is kind of where I would go. The only difference is that, you know, we tend to love narratives. And if the narrative now is that, I mean, look back at like, you know, the 60s is like everybody wants to draw everything from, the space race was going on and now everybody was more, pushing toward the impossible. And we wanted to read books about the great beyond and all the craziness. And that's why all these other things got done. Or like, you know, that past Watergate, we were in a very conspiratorial time and it meant that we didn't trust authority as much. So I would say if we either in either of those scenarios that, you know, we find out that aliens are light years away or
there's a parallel universe next door.
Yeah, parallel universes, then number one, it becomes a gigantic news story, the likes of which will constantly populate throughout, like, oh, well, this person adjacent to this thing is now a 72-hour news story because they said a thing or they're close to a thing. But in reality, you're right. We're just going to kind of live our lives and just put a new coat of paint on it.
That's fascinating because I didn't even think about it because you're right. The biggest effect this would have, because it's not like anything changed, and it's very likely not that we'll ever be able to punch a hole to the other universe or even knock on the door and say, hey, it's us. Like, nothing changes. The biggest significant impact of this being proved true would be a giant cultural shift. Whatever that looks like, you know, whatever that means, some kind of confirmation.
And also, I don't even know if there would be. I know that we would say there would be because
correct.
We always do. But ultimately, what happens is, you know, Watergate happens. It's a gigantic news story. And everybody says, oh, yeah, no, we just became more conspiratorial. And you can point to a few, you know, polls and stuff like that. Or you can point to other works of fiction that were greenlit because people were in the mood for it. But that does that mean that we really as a people became more conspiratorial or we didn't trust authority anymore? I don't know. Maybe, but it sure is a great story.
It just means that use of the word, if you could buy stock in the word multiverse, post-multiverse. Well, post-multiverse, you know, does it really matter how our politicians are acting? Yes, no, it still does.
I do think that you could say it would probably lead to more money going into that kind of scientific research. And if we are seeing something that is quantifiable right now, and I wish that we would talk about it more on this podcast with private space travel, but
it's never going to happen, Justin.
Never going to happen.
It's just not
one
really
of the uncovered topics here on Weird Things, but like this is something that is going to radically change how we think of life. And it is because a bunch of billionaires got a boner for putting things into space. Right. And everything that had to lead up to that is part of the story. But, you know, right now, if you were to look at us from 1950 to 2018 and say there is legitimate, you know, before the Black Panther 3 comes out, we could be looking at a trip, a manned trip to Mars. That's from that perspective. Oh my God. Like, what? I bet you everybody's got Mars fever and the Mars jitterbug is taking over all the
things. Martian jitterbug.
But for us, it's like, no, I don't know. I'm more pissed off about how Logan Paul's on Twitch. It's just like the things of the day will always kind of outweigh the larger things, even when they are massive. I mean, like, if we're at the dawning of humanity becoming a legitimate multi-planet species, this is like the biggest thing that we could possibly do for the expansion of our species, for what all of our cultures would ever have a hope. If we ever want to survive beyond, you know, where we would think of now, what we are doing now, recording in to a easily, infinitely storable platform and spreading it around the universe is the greatest thing ever. And yet, you know, here I am looking at my phone because I got an app that has like Chinese factories that'll sell me a cheap watch. And I'm like, oh, look. Is that worth $5? Let me think about that. It's taking up more time in my day than these gigantic, large scope things.
So what if we get hypothetical and go, let's say we go forward 200 years in the future. Let's say in 200 years in the future.
Still alive. Still doing the Weird Things podcast. Mostly robot, mostly existing in the cloud, but still here.
And so let's
Andrew Main, still on assignment.
Still on assignment. One day
we're really looking forward to it.
Well, let's just say with the following assumptions that we do find out that a multiverse theory is possible. And let's say... Oh, next week we are going to have a viewport into some other parallel.
So not the ability to travel, but it's like we have like enough information that we can see into the other world.
Yeah. What do you think is the best case and worst case scenario of that very specific hypothetical situation? The idea that we could stare into a completely different universe or a parallel.
I would like to think that if we are to take this hypothetical one step further, the worst case scenario is a version of me that is in a better shape and wearing more expensive clothes comes to visit me and says, "Oh, really?" I'm out of here. Now, I was thinking, and it's an awkward moment. It's like, "Were you going to take my place?" And he's like, "Yeah, I mean, I thought that, but you, I mean, it's made me thankful for my life. I'll tell you that.
So he goes up. He looks at you right in the eye. He's like, "Huh? So you chose to go to Syracuse, huh?"
And he, okay. Well, podcasting. That wasn't just a phase. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Cool. Anyway, see you later.
And then you're like, "Oh, did that make it over?" It's like, "Yeah, I sent you the thought. We have thought transmitters and everything. It's in fact, I came to collect my royalties on all this IP you're using."
Yeah, I've been trying to steer you down a more profitable path with no avail, by the way.
Okay, cool. Because I'm like, part of when I read this, I thought, "Oh, hey. How different is this from, say, the plot of the show Counterpart?"
Well, I would assume very, very different, because I assume parallel universes, theoretically, I would imagine that they all have the same origin point, possibly at different times or whatever. Yeah. So the likelihood that it's a neighborhood next door in which there's even a planet Earth, in which there's even a Milky Way is vanishingly infinitely small, right? Because, you know, chaos theory, you can start with virtually the same identical seed and very quickly everything's unrecognizable. And in the, 13 or so billion year history of the universe, the odds of us having this same little planet, very small. But let's say it did.
Cool.
Okay. Let's say it did.
Okay.
Then in some way, and this is kind of a weird thing, mm-hmm. this I would even say in 300 years, this would not be a hypothetical. This would be a reality. And it wouldn't be because we punched a hole to the universe next door. It would be because in 300 years, I can easily picture us having the processing power to model our current world so well that we can roll it back to, let's say, you know, 1800s and Lincoln doesn't get assassinated, and then roll it forward so well that each individual person can show up and you can have conversations with AI bots exactly modeling based on all the existing data. Or let's say you roll it back to last week, right? Let's say 300 years from now, systems are so advanced, quantum computing so powerful, memory infinite, there's a global brain or whatever. You could say, roll it back to last week. Show me what would have happened had this shot made it before the buzzer at this game. And this isn't even necessarily hypothetical at this point. I think we can actually get the benefit of that without ever having to break physics to do it.
So a miniverse.
A teenyverse, a microverse.
So you would just be manipulating this teenyverse to find out like what would have happened if you know you would have gotten the nerve to ask that girl for a number or something like that.
I would imagine.
That almost sounds like, and this is getting cyclical, because then, like, who is to say that that's not exactly what's happening to us right now?
And the chat is right on that. Tinvec says, Brian, that's the actual argument that we live in a simulation right now. And it's not a bad argument. And wouldn't it be interesting if it wasn't true for us, but we made it true for someone else?
And we end up being the very top level.
Yeah. And the more I think about it.
You know what? I think, but... I also think if you were making one of those universes, you would set it so that they thought they were the top level, and it seemed like they were the top level.
I would set it and forget it.
Here's like a
different god, Brian Rushwood.
Like, what if we had a parallel universe that was remarkably consistent with our own world, similar countries and cultures and languages and stuff like that? All those kind of develop. But what doesn't happen is like what needs to happen in most science fiction stories, where it's like all of our grandparents met all of our great grandparents and everybody is kind of like gone through the exact same genealogical thing. Instead, you just need to find through whatever calculations the person who's kind of the most genetically close to you. And so maybe your dad never met your mom or whatever, but now there is somebody that basically shares where you are at the same time, but instead of it being like an exact version of you, it's just like, you know, Eddie Giuseppe is like my other person. He like waits tables in Italy, and so, I'm just like oh, I guess you're me.
So the one thing I would insist upon on that, let's say whether it be a program running all the simulations or whatever, is I need you to filter out all the versions in which there's a better version of me. Only show me the scrubs.
Vanity universal simulation.
Yes, exactly. Let's simulate not just one universe, but thousands of them, so I can feel good about
that. That are all lesser than me.
Yes. By the way, the yin and yang of Brian and I is I'm like, the worst case scenario is a better version of me shows up and is judgmental. Brian's like, the best case scenario is I get to find all the worst versions of me and judge them performatively.
Oh my gosh. Well, if you want the best version of this show.
Nicely done.
You can support us over at patreon.com/weirdthings. Tell them what they get, guys.
You know what? You get smug satisfaction. You want to see the lesser version of you? Look in the mirror if you've not used Patreon. But if you have used it, look at an old picture of you from before you used Patreon.
That's a fact, folks. Look, it's scientifically proven. Patreon equals happiness. If you are happy, then head on over there and make us even happier by way of money, by donating to this show. Look at this. You can get your custom RSS feed. Science thought that this was impossible until very recently, that you can get a custom RSS feed that you can put into the podcatcher of your choice and make sure that you get After Things, the show that we do after Weird Things that focuses more on business and entrepreneurship and creativity. Hey, get up off your ass and do something. because you listen to After Things, and we will give you all of our advice as to how to do it. You get it early if you're a Patreon. So go ahead and do it. What do you say? Hey, what are you not happy? Get happy and then go over to patreon.com/weirdthings.
That's right. And hey, it helps make sure that the show keeps happening. This is the second week without Andrew. A couple years ago, that probably would not have resulted in episodes
You know what?
Happening.
We don't need to look into an alternate reality. We can look at actual history, when we went entire months while he was on assignments without doing episodes. But all that changed thanks to you guys at patreon.com/weirdthings.
By the way, I think someone, I don't know if it was Leon who runs the BBpedia videos account, was saying that Weird Things' 300th episode was like a week or two ago.
Wow. I believe it, man.
Yeah.
It's been a hot minute.
It's been a minute. But thank you, everybody who supports us.
And also, we need to redo all of our Patreon. Like that literally just needs, we just need to all get together. Like, all of us that do these Patreons together, we just need to reshoot all of them. Because, like, we have just been doing them for so long. Like, we've been doing this for so long, and we've had Patreon for long enough that now it's like, now look at that, and, like, Brian's studio is completely different from where it is. I was shooting that at the Go Game office. Like, Andrew is pretty much where he was, but, you know.
Also
it was,
looking ageless and timeless and the same as he always does.
Oh, God, it's Dorian Gray weirdo.
So we have one last story here. This one, I'm interested in to hear your takes on it. A few weeks back, one of these weeks when Andrew was gone, we talked about Human Z's. You guys remember Human Z's?
Oh, yes. Disturbing thoughts.
These are the idea of via some sort of insemination process that a hybrid between a human and a chimpanzee, because they're so genetically similar and we believe them to be on the same evolutionary timeline, that there is a middle species between the two that through hybridization could exist, a human Z.
Yeah, my virtual Andrew simulation wants to correct you and say that there was a common branch somewhere back behind us. But if what you're proposing would be like a middle cousin, like we're not evolved. Neither of us are evolved from each other, but but maybe there's a middle version somewhere in between.
Very good point. Because there are other hybridization animals, ligers, labradoodles, labradors and poodles.
Well, no, those are all dogs. Dogs can all.
But it's interspecies.
No, those aren't species. Breeds. A species is defined by the, because everything's amorphous, right? Animal, every species can, or many species can copulate with each other,
sure.
But they don't bear any kind of animal that can self-replicate. For example, like a mule is what, a donkey and a horse or something?
Mm-hmm.
A mule is sterile. It can't make another mule. Same thing, I think, with the liger, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas dogs,
sure,
as we know, they can all make fertile dogs after theirs.
I'm just going based off of this article I'm about to bring, which called them subspecies.
Okay, great. Got it.
And so this is a partially opinion piece from David P. Barish over at Nautilus, from their 58th issue, making the argument that maybe with the ability to fine tune genetic markers, that maybe it's time to create a human Z.
So
on the surface, what is your reaction to that?
This
general
is like the reverse argument for eugenics. Some may say it sounds just like eugenics, but so eugenics back in the early 20th century had the thesis that by interbreeding with lesser people, they would say anything from the mentally infirm to the Irish, because it was a very racist movement.
Yeah.
That we were weakening the species, but when in fact it's the opposite, because the more highly diverse species is, you know, as the environment changes, something that was a detriment, you know, think of sickle cell anemia, mm-hmm. is a detriment, but except for when you have malaria, and all of a sudden you're just like, ooh, I wish I had some of that sickle cell anemia, mm-hmm. and you obviously, humanity benefited greatly from somebody who had the quote-unquote genetically defective makeup of Stephen Hawking and ended up being a huge contributor to society.
Yeah.
This kind of takes that to the extreme, where it's saying Let's be even more diverse. Let's be diverse in ways that aren't even possible by old-fashioned mating within our species, which I think triggers a repugnance, the same repugnance that the same... Man, this is a weird thing to say. I'm going to really try to thread this needle. Eugenics ultimately was an aesthetics-based argument that was factually wrong. Mm-hmm. It turns out that it is better to have lots of diversity and lots of interbreeding for the health of a tribe, of a culture, of a society. Likewise, I feel the repugnance of the idea of splicing in human Z, but I have to give pause knowing the cautionary tale of what was obvious to everybody in the days of eugenics. I wonder if the repugnance I feel right now, 100 years from now, will look like horrifically backward thinking to my human Z great-great-grandchildren.
So so to kind of sum up your conflict here is that you're not sure if this benefits humanity to do this or the human gene pool.
Well,
boiled down.
That's what my gut says, but then my brain says that's what people thought about eugenics. They thought it was gross to interbreed with different races, and they were wrong. And so I have my gut instinct, and then it immediately is followed by, they were wrong, you're probably wrong. And this is a really interesting idea.
So the baseline of the repulsion beyond, you know, I guess the baseline is just that you would try to do something like this, and that this is a macabre pursuit that would yield, you know, little scientifically and be cruel on the other end of it. But to explore that cruelty, the issue is that you are creating a freak that will die because we, you know, it will live a short and painful life. And you know, what is the benefit of that? Right. So what is this article?
Well, this article is saying that not only might it be possible to do a human Z, but there's a moral imperative now that we have the tools to start tinkering with it.
Well, not quite. So part of Barish's argument actually centers around the idea of trying to. This is a pretty long piece. I recommend people check this out at Nautilus. That
what would we search for to find it at Nautilus?
You could look up issue 58.
Okay,
it's in their 58 issue. It's time to make human chimp hybrids is the headline.
That is a bold shot called.
But the idea is that
sounds like a Gawker headline, guys. It's totally time to make human chimp hybrids.
So, part of the argument is that we live, we as humans exist on the planet in a world where we see ourselves, humanity, and all others, which is animal kind, basically.
Oh, so they're saying that is an unhelpful social distinction, and that bridging that gap, creating hybrids, would wear away at that us versus man. The very idea of man versus nature is no longer a helpful idea,
right?
Because man is of nature, and a human-chimpanzee hybrid might help to erode that idea.
Right. Basically, the idea of, well, on a large scale, if we soften this edge between these two ideas of the superior human and the animal thing, that we may treat animals en masse better than we currently do.
Right. Because we, I mean, there's certainly...
Oh, wait. Oh, that's the moral argument? The moral argument is that we need to reframe how we think of animals?
Yeah.
I don't know about all that. I just think that's like, oh, we need to go to space to make Tang and Velcro. Like, you know, yeah, that might happen, but you need better reasons to make a human Z than just people might have more sympathy for the chimpanzee in the end.
I'm gonna quote his article here. On the other hand, it seems equally likely that faced with individuals who are clearly intermediate between human and ape, it will become painfully obvious that a rigid distinction between the two is no longer tenable. He makes the statement that the lives of those intermediate beings, would probably not be very good. And
I mean, well, and that's the like this is some Island of Dr. Moreau stuff happening.
Sure.
It's but when you take our inherent disgust out of it, it certainly would be a rich treasure trove of information, but it would also be laden with insane amounts of some would I think some would call it unnecessary suffering. Man.
All right, here, Brian. Let's say this guy all of a sudden black helicopter lands on his lawn.
Right.
Which is weird because he lives in Brooklyn, and so it's a very tiny helicopter.
the helicopter comes down, lays out a lawn, and then lands on it.
And then lands
blocking
on it.
Blocking traffic.
You know, mirrored sunglasses, trench coat guy with a briefcase comes in and says, we've been reading your writing in that one magazine, and we, the United States government, want to set up a black site where nobody will ever know. It's some part of the Pentagon's budget that will just kind of go into it. You are here only for scientific study, so you'll be overseen by the top, you know, the top of the top in terms of military science. But we believe that there is a value in experimenting with this kind of stuff. But we also know that humanity is not that, you know, right now the world is not ready to like watch the step by step of how the sausage is made. Maybe if there are medical breakthroughs that we can bring back from such experimentation, then you can live your beautiful dream of making humans look at chimpanzees better. But right now, this is just going to be you experimenting out there. Now, Brian, I'm asking you your moral judgment. You know that this is happening. Do you feel good or bad about this black site being set up?
I think I would feel bad, but that's all tinged with like, is that what I want my tax dollars? I'm John Stossling it. The government wants to make human Z's.
Give me a banana. And yeah, it's not the government. It's Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel's helicopter lands right next to the
Pentagon
officials.
He's seasteading. He finally does his seasteading. He's like, hey, seasteading, not a joke, not a fad, actually happened. Mm-hmm. Nobody's discovered it. It's like Kong Skull Island. It's under a perpetual cloud.
We have all chimpanzees and no Gawker.
It's a beautiful wonderland.
He takes this guy and it's like, na-na-na-na. He's like, do you have the Jurassic Park thing on? He's like, yeah, it's I don't know. It's my thing. I built it. I like
the radio's broken. So, I don't really know what's going on.
So it's private. Are you okay?
I guess the question is, if I go on a tour of this, I guess a lot of it depends on what I see. So let's say all I do is I receive photos that conclusively prove it's being done. The question is, do I blow the whistle and say, this is a terrible thing that's happening, we've got to stop it? Do I rally the troops?
Oh, boy.
I mean, in some ways, that's what's already happening with animal testing labs. There is significant benefit to some. There's significant benefit to some animal testing, and there's insignificant benefit to some animal testing. And some of it is fruitless and cruel. Some of it is humane and beneficial. And there's all kinds, and not only beneficial, hugely beneficial, not just for humans, but for the entire planet. And so as a result, like, am I inherently against animal testing? No, I'm not.
Yeah, but you're the key, the operative phrase there is animal period.
Well, but there's also human testing, right? There's psychological experiments, there's drug trials, there's double blind things, and some of it ends up going terribly and creates a lot of suffering for humans. You know what? Now that you put it this way, if I'm okay with animal testing and I'm okay with human testing, I think logically I have to be okay with animal human testing.
Wait, you don't think that there are a few stops along the road before you're creating humanzees between like I'm going to sign up on my own will for a trial. If I'm a human, like I'm going to get, I'm going to receive payment. I'm going to understand the risks as they're spelled out to me.
Maybe,
like,
maybe this is one of, this might be a side effect of me growing up or going to college in Austin, Texas, where everybody knew who PPC Pharmaco was. And if you've ever lived in Austin, you know who PPC Pharmaco was, because if you needed some cash, they would sign you up with a drug trial. You didn't get to pick your drug. You didn't get to pick what happened to you afterwards. And yeah. I heard everything from my first assistant when I was on the road touring with Magic was one of the first people to test out a little thing called Xanax. And he was he was not the most effective assistant I've ever had on the road. meanwhile, another guy made a lot of money. He was young and healthy, and he said, "Yeah, they told me it's an Alzheimer's drug." And it's like, "Do you feel anything?" He's like, "No, I don't feel anything."
Yeah, I feel like I've got some Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Well, and then he made like $2,000 in a month, and wow. And then separate from that, floating down the Guadalupe River, somebody is drunk out of his mind in a tube floating down, and our group floats past him, and his feet are gnarled. He looks like a clicker from The Last of Us, just gnarled stuff coming off his feet, and he's just like, "Don't do pharmaco, guys. It's a bad thing."
Oh, Jesus.
So, is it bad that pharmaco existed? That's for history to say.
So one of the examples that is brought up in this is the idea that we are using animals and using chimerization basically to grow human organs in pigs.
Yeah, that's right. And that is, I think, unquestionably a good thing, but there are ethical concerns about the more we bridge that gap, what if pig viruses suddenly they morph into those middle grounds, and then they're able to make the leap? Because right now there's a lot of pig diseases that humans can't get. Mm-hmm. Once we have these pig-human hybrid organs, I mean, it's great that we're saving people with new livers and new bladders and so on, but now we've reduced the barrier of challenges for a pig flu to jump over to a human flu, which might be terrible. But if you're theorizing that we've now, mastered the video game called How Life Works Genetically, then that's something that might be able to work. It's almost like this is a big heady issue, and it's not really up to Brian Brushwood.
No, it's not. Justin, do you have a sense on this?
My instinct is that, look, science is built to break barriers, and there are some barriers for which are harder to push down, and I think that kind of the beauty of the scientific method and those that would make their living in it in research is that there are kind of natural cultural things for which are protected. My biggest issue would be more that, like, it would be a intensely cruel life to bring into the world that would almost assuredly live its short life in pain and then die. And then the question is, okay, well then, are we doing that repeatedly until we get one to live? Like, is this?
I mean, that's how life did it. I mean, that's how planet Earth ran that experiment, only much more cruel and with no guidance.
Well, and
certainly
part of the argument here is that we do the exact same things with perfectly healthy animals for our own gain. Right?
Like, yeah,
between factory farming or, creating chimeras to grow human organs. I guess in that point,
then yeah, you can say, hey, look, we already make these moral things. We just don't think of them as moral compromises because we like that steak, dog. Let's get that chicken nugget, right? Like, so why not do it for a more scientifically, interesting reason other than just like, yeah, no, we kill animals all the time.
Yeah.
But do we kill human? Do we kill a half human all the time? I guess you want to know what? I'm kind of coming around to this guy's point of view that, like, the more you think about it, the more you're like, no, my issue is the half human part. Like, am I creating a human, half of a human to kill it?
Interesting. Well, it's certainly a heavy topic.
Man, you know it's a big one when we can't solve it in 15 minutes of a podcast. That's a real head scratcher, this one. I guess it is challenging.
But if you have your take on it, for our listeners out there.
Oh, yeah, please write in. This would be a fun one. I would love to hear everybody's take on this.
You can find the email in the show notes.
In fact, actually, can we commit to doing like a mailbag next week on this one if everybody writes in?
Yeah, if we get some, send them in. You find the email address and the subject line in the show notes of where you're listening to this now. Do you guys have any picks?
Oh, do we not want to give it out on the air, or is that
Neshcom@gmail.com.
Okay,
just put weird things in the subject line.
Neshcom@gmail.com. We will do a mailbag if you write in. So Neshcom@gmail.com. Put weird things in the subject line because he's not going to read literally every email to find out if it's a weird things topic. Just put weird things in the subject line.
That's all you have to do,
folks.
Do you guys have picks?
Yes, I do. I am unbelievably excited about this pick. I just finished it, Justin. I just finished it, and I need you to hurry the hell up so I can talk to you about it. The book is Ryan Holiday's Conspiracy. It is all about Conspiracy by Ryan Holiday. It sounds like he's the one with the conspiracy.
No.
It's about the unbelievable true tale of how the Hulk Hogan decision broke Gawker and the reveal after the fact that Peter Thiel for 6 years had run a secret conspiracy to take down Gawker, and the seed of it all began when Gawker outed him as gay. It also ties in. Number one, it's all told through Ryan Holiday's incredible historical perspective. This guy reads so much philosophy and history, and it all comes through. Fantastic quotes and lessons from all throughout history, successful and unsuccessful conspiracies. Lots of Machiavelli in there. Also, unbelievable access. He spoke to everyone. He spoke to Hulk Hogan. He spoke to the founder of Gawker. He spoke to the guy who published the article that was in question. He spoke a lot to Peter Thiel. He spoke to the secret unnamed Mr. A, who is the who as a young 20-something had a few minutes to speak with Peter Thiel and say, hey, I have an idea on how you could destroy Gawker. And so began a conspiracy of two that grew. And he talks about how close the clean getaway was and why conspiracies fail after the fact. And he makes the unbelievable counterintuitive claim that we should live in a world with more conspiracies, not fewer. And he makes a lot of cases for, you know, America was built on a conspiracy. There's a lot of genuinely good things that happen in secret where people commit to change the world. And it's just great. I can't wait for you guys to read it and talk to me about it.
Cool.
So I read the AMA, and I've not read of I know you're a fan of that dude's previous.
He wrote a book, Ego is the Enemy, that was literally life changing for me. He wrote The Obstacle is the Way, which is a book on stoicism and just doing what it takes to get things done. Lots of Marcus Aurelius in there. Really good stuff.
I read his AMA, and I was heartened to read it because it kind of, you know, maybe in confirmation bias, seemed to confirm part of what I had read into the Gawker Peter Thiel thing, which was that, yes, Peter Thiel was actively trying to kill Gawker, but in a very interesting way. Like, he knew that Gawker was, to metaphorically put it in an abstract, Gawker had a heroin addiction, and sure, it could continue to do heroin safely, but every once in a while, it would get really, really, really close to the danger zone, probably more often than they wanted to admit. And, you know, so Peter Thiel's way of killing them was just by, you know, maybe putting some dirty heroin around, never to them directly, but just around their dangerous patterns of behavior, maybe just laying a landmine here or there and then efforting things to go bad. So basically, they knew, I don't know why I made that metaphor, Peter Thiel knew that Gawker was pushing the lines of libel, and that they had to prove libel, specifically in the case of public figures. It's intensely, very, very, very hard to do, and you have to show that you did it with malice. And that you put, like, it was a lot
egregious.
Of tumblers have to click into place for a jury to do it. to find you guilty of something like that in the case of a public figure. And what it seemed like, at least by the AMA, and I'm excited to read the book, Peter Thiel's thing was like, look, as long as they have not learned their lesson and they keep stepping in these bear traps and then crowing about how awesome they are that they can step in any bear trap they want and never never face any consequences, then I'm going to keep investing in smarter and better bear traps. That was way better than the heroin analogy. way better.
Well, specifically, there's a moment in the book where he and Mr. A are sitting down thinking through, like, what's on the table? Okay, literally everything's on the table. Everything from, you know, hire a hitman on down. They don't give that example, but just, you know, there's moral issues and there's legal issues and all that stuff. And they realize, well, I have too much to lose. If we get found out, and it's a, you know, it comes out that I hired private investigators or whatever, that's too big a cost for me. So they end up limiting it to legal methods that will be defensible after the fact, which is a huge limitation if your goal is to give a killing blow to a company that is, you know, growing. It was like $150 million valuation at its height. So what they realize is they have to figure out – they also figure out that you can't take them down on the First Amendment. First Amendment is very, very strong, and it's too easy to – there are stronger libel laws in England, but all that's going to do is give them a slap on the wrist. They'll pay a fine, and they'll still be doing their thing. He's like, I want to break this engine. And so it's like we need a killing blow. We need to catch them doing something that's flat out illegal or could be interpreted as such. Mm. And so ultimately, when the trial comes down, you get to a place where one side is arguing First Amendment means you get to say anything you want, period, no matter what. And the offense never brings up first. Or, I mean, they address the First Amendment, but they make it very clear. It's like we're not talking about the First Amendment. We are talking about the criminal act of destroying a person's life by taking stolen materials, taken from a private residence, taking a man and hanging him out to dry the way they did with Hulk Hogan or whatever. Even when you know the outcome to it, the ebb and flow, the sports game, it's like, oh, it's looking good for this side. Oh, it's looking good for that side. Oh, what a huge setback. Oh, what hubris on both sides. He is so even-handed. There are moments he makes Gawker seem positively relatable, you know? It's like you're on their side.
Is this Holiday or Thiel?
Ryan Holiday is what he does
in his book.
So Holiday in describing it gives Gawker a fair shake.
Correct. Well, and you know, it's up to you to decide if it's a fair shake, but I know that there were times I was very sympathetic to the founder of Gawker, to the guy who published the article. He always takes a moment for every single character to give a very fair, compelling representation of what their position was. And as a result, you know, his thesis of this is, you know, one of the most fascinating conspiracies. Anyway, I don't want to spoil everything. I could go on and on and on about it. This is all stuff I want to talk to Justin about.
Spoiler alert, don't go to Gawker.com.
Although I will say, if you're curious about the book, that same AMA that I forwarded over to Justin, I think is a good place to read. Just look up Ryan Holiday AMA on Reddit, and you can read through a lot of – he'll do a very good job of pitching the book to you.
And make sure you get the one from 2018. I think he did one in 2017 as well.
Yeah.
Did you ever see – I know, Justin, you saw it, Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press.
Yes, and I didn't like it. And I didn't like it because I think it – did a disservice not only in the Gawker case but also in the other cases that they brought up that they tried to string together. That A, I didn't think that the other cases necessarily had much to do with the Gawker case. I think the Gawker case is very, very unique. But also, look, the First Amendment is so protected. It is a very, very, very protected part of our culture, and it has, you know, helped me make a living when I was working in that industry, and helps us protect our living that we have now, right? But at the same time, when you are able to have that freedom as a press outlet, you need to know where the electric fences are, and you need to know when to pull back. In fact, knowing when to pull back is the way that you continue to have the license to do everything else that you want to do. And that can up to and include ruin a person's life accidentally. You can publish a bunch of stuff that's like, all right, we screwed up. We accidentally got the wrong name here and we called somebody a murderer. And now everybody in this town thinks that somebody is a murderer. And you can go to court and say, hey, look, here's the Jar Jar Binks path that we took that accidentally led us to call this guy a murderer. And you will not be charged. I mean, you might settle it or something like that because you don't want to spend the legal fees. But you can, the courts, because of the First Amendment, the courts can say, well, didn't mean to do it. Sorry, Mr. Not Murderer. Like, let's make sure that they run that you're not a murderer on the front page. Gawker was a habitual line stepper, and they made their brand line stepping. And I understand. I loved Gawker. I continue to enjoy a lot of the blogs that came out of it. But that was under that leadership. That was what they wanted to build their brand on. And if you continue to try and cross these lines, again, that's what I thought the Thiel strategy was like, could have been stopped. Thiel's grand plan to kill Gawker could have ended if they would have stopped getting themselves in these kinds of situations.
Well, there's one moment of the book he makes a compelling argument for. It could have been stopped with literally one apology. But they're steadfast, all or nothing. We get to do whatever we want. No, this will never go to trial. You'll never take us. We've got the First Amendment. Like the hubris that they revealed, it's an astonishing, compelling read. I was telling Justin last night, I went for a walk and started listening. I didn't want to stop, and I ended up walking 6 miles. It was fantastic.
No, look, I mean, so to the Nobody Speak thing, I think that's a fascinating, I watched that documentary hoping that I would get a kind of fuller picture, but this is just, this isn't about Nobody Speak, this is about in general journalism stuff and including fictional portrayals like the Post and stuff like that, where journalism is ugly, it's workaday, it's boring, it is sometimes messy. It is not the like warrior Christ that descend from heaven and bring truth and vitality to the culture. Hopefully that happens, but like the idea that the narrative of like mean old rich guy picks on young scrappy upstarts, it's more complicated than that. And I think it sends the wrong messages of what journalism and the First Amendment kind of really is, because it is a living relationship with your readership and with the culture at large. And if you are never giving back on anything, you're not being a good steward of what these laws are there for.
Well, that's one of the surprise, you know, again, spoiler alert at the end, he does a brief analysis on how the legal world of law professors reacted to the Gawker decision. And universally, they're like, this doesn't feel like First Amendment has eroded at all. This feels like a very specific niche that in general society is going to be okay with, just like, you know, rape of, you know, used to be tolerated and is no more. You know, we will look back at the time in the early aughts when the internet was so novel that legit journalism outlets would publish upskirt photos of celebrities not wearing underwear, getting out of limos. We will look at that with disgust and horror, just, you know, in a similar vein.
Cool. Justin, do you have a pick?
Nobody Speak. Just kidding. No, I watched, we just finished last night, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon. This is a series that just came out from Amy Sherman Palladino and her husband. These are the two that brought you The Gilmore Girls. It is kind of loosely based on the life of and the origin story of Joan Rivers, basically a woman who decides she wants to go into stand-up comedy, loves stand-up comedy in an era that does not traditionally kind of foster that. And the first couple episodes I really, 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 really liked. And then some of the Amy Sherman Palladino things that I find a little insufferable about, you know, some of the Gilmore Girls and other stuff that she's done sort of rears its head, AKA people talking about their feelings with no movement in the plot for two episodes. But other than that, look, it's a, if you like the kind of early you know, the birth of comedy kind of stuff, the birth of stand-up, then you will enjoy it, including fictional portrayals of real life people like Lenny Bruce and kind of the origins of what we now understand to be kind of stand-up, and where it sort of came from its like variety, Borscht Belt kind of beginnings.
Cool. I have a pick. I so much didn't like the previous series of this show that on our Cord Killers year-end countdown show, the
Achilles, you gave it a kill. You said don't. I said die.
I said stop watching Terrace House Aloha State, which was really bad. But they have a new series out called Opening New Doors, and it's fantastic. So if you don't know Terrace House, it is a Japanese reality show that they brought over to Netflix, and it just follows six kids living in a house together who go in trying to find romance and get their career started. And the thing I really didn't like about Aloha State is that it started off with a pretty junky cast of characters, where Opening New Doors starts with like the best, most amazing six people. And it is in Nagano, this series. So last one was in Hawaii, and now this one is kind of in the more rural, snowy part of Japan. And it's just so great. The ways that it's like on paper very similar to like a real world style show, but the way that it is portrayed as being very like slight and very subtle is really great, you know.
Slight and subtle, like, I mean, you mean Japanese?
Well, okay. But I mean, that is a cultural distinction, right?
Sure,
like,
sure.
Like, it is, like, so the first eight episodes came out to international Netflix. In the Japanese Netflix, it comes out every week. Like, the big, like, fight moment is when a woman yells at this kid that he does not know what he's doing with his life, and he's being obstinate and cocky, and he just needs to like get his stuff together. Where the real world was like very explosive and very physical. It's great. You see like very tender romance bloom, and you see very awkward romance trying to happen and definitely not going to happen. It's really cool. I really think if you haven't tried one.
So what brought you back to it after having given it up? Just that it was a new, you're like, all right, I'm giving you one more try.
Yeah, basically this new series came up, the past few weeks, really recently. And I had heard good things, and I really loved the first series that they brought to Netflix, which was Boys and Girls in the City.
Mm-hmm.
But when I fell off of Aloha State, I was glad to see they maybe recognize that and change direction. So it's really cool, and there's a fun, I actually just found out, so the other cool thing about the show is that it is broken up with these panel segments where these six recurring people, comedians and personalities, will stop in the middle of the show and just talk about everything that's happened in that episode.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, oh my God, can you believe what if this guy said this? And like,
these are people who aren't in the drama. They're outside of it. Got it.
They're not in the show. They are like,
but they're helping us help shape the narrative.
Yeah. Like if you were watching it with someone, these are the things that you would talk about with them. Like, can you believe that he tried this awful pickup line with her and they went through this whole long hour? He asked her to drive on the date, and there's something really refreshing about that, of like having it, your own built-in response portion. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's one of many really interesting things about the way that show is, as a reality show, is different from the way we make reality shows in the West.
Awesome.
So I recommend checking that out. Terrace House Opening New Doors, and that's going to do it for the Weird Things podcast. Today, thank you, Brian.
Yeah, man. Thank you, Justin. I hear Sasquatch knocking at the door. Yeah. I gotta go.
Hey, thank you for knocking at the door, Sasquatch.
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.